probably an old train arm. Likely. Here's the thing about the microphone. The microphones are strictly for recording purposes for our sound guy in the back. So they will try and speak up a little, but they're not going to be for amplification. So you speak up, we'll speak up, but then everybody will be able to hear each other. And I'm Gary Manal with Warner Home Video. I can't see your faces, so I'm not going to identify you by names. But I'll stay right here. First question.
We need you to swap this chair out for one bit of broken chair.
Find color in your
hair.
I was terribly, terribly upset, actually. And I think if we're all honest, we all were. And so it was very, very sad.
It was. Don't set him off.
The fire in the castle.
It was very emotional. I thought that for David Yates, Hayden, and myself, because we were literally dying the death of a thousand cuts, because we had a year in the editing room, I would particularly find it sort of okay, you know, yes, a bit sad we're finished, but, you know, I've got a year to go and I'm all right. But it was very emotional. We found a very cynical scene of the three of them, Dan Rupert and Emma, jumping into onto a green screen bag. It was for an element where they jumped into the fireplace of the Ministry of Magic in part one. And we deliberately kept it simple and non-involved, not a big dramatic scene, because it wouldn't be fair for them to have to do that. And then so we're finished. But at the end, we played the assistant director put together a reel of whether we call it the golden ball every day, because it was such an immensely long schedule. Different people held up a kind of a clapperboard with day one of 6 million, or whatever it was on there, and so he cut together a little reel of all of this and played that, and it just left everyone in tears. It was extraordinarily emotional.
Yeah, it was surprisingly emotional. I was there on the last day as well. I was doing a shot with another unit and walked in to see the scene that David described there being finished, and then watching these video clips of the past year and a half to 2 years flashing before us in 10 minutes. Was really moving. And, you know, it kind of sounds a bit strange sitting here talking about it in that way, but, after working on something for 10 years, no project I've ever been involved with has gone on that long. You know, it was like working on a soap opera, in a sense, of like that regular sort of work that and getting to know this huge family of people amongst the cast and, of course, the crew, and then becoming very familiar with the studios at Leavesden as well. Over the years, and to be kind of saying goodbye to all of that, even though we all see each other at events like this, and it's nice to get together again. It was sad, and I'll certainly miss it, even though it was, you know, sometimes painful to be under all that makeup and stuff. You know, I certainly look back with great fondness of the whole experience and feel really honoured to have been part of it, and now it's just going to be great to sort of have that legacy, you know, to kind of... to hand down to generations, you know, on DVD, Blu-ray, and whatever else they care to invent in the future.
Is this not available?
Hey, it is. It's funny you should say that. Yes.
Yes. I've got the extras for download as well.
Yes, which is my preference, to be honest.
Yes. He's always been a downloader.
Obviously, legally only. I would just want to point that out.
Years
actually, if I could predict my obituary in 40 years, I'd be delighted given the age I am now.
I'm rather glad this will be my obituary for the next 4 years, because before that, I think it would have been that I was sodomized by Leonardo DiCaprio. on film, I should say.
I'll always be good.
But I mean, to be remembered for something like Harry Potter is a terrific thing to be remembered for, if that is what it shall be. And I don't know whether you mean it's not a blight on a career on a CV at all. It's something that, you know, is something to be proud of, and that's certainly my perspective on it.
Right here.
Works on Half-Blood Prince, so I haven't, like, he's not been working on it for a decade. I've only been working for about a year or so. I don't think I'll be under that same umbrella. I don't think I'll. I mean, with any actor, I think you've always got that dreadful fear that some of those performances have got a lot of similarities in them, and you've always got that constant internal battle. But I don't think I have that with Cormac McLaggen.
It was a bit different for me because I was able to leave those characters behind. You know, once that face comes off, you know, I do literally leave that in the makeup room, because in all of the films, I never looked like the guy you see before you. So, I was able to leave those behind. I mean, and again, it was with sort of sadness to a certain extent. You know, having to say goodbye because I'm fond of the characters. You know, as actors, you put a little piece of yourself into everything that you do, and there is an affection that you have with them. However nasty a character it might be, there's something. It's an essence of you in it, and it's, you know, it's sort of sad not to play that character for the last time. And because during all of the making of all these 8 films, you know, none of us knew for sure, but you kind of always had fingers crossed when they were writing the next screenplay that your character would be involved, or when J.K. Rowling was writing her next book that you would see the character feature in there somewhere. So you had that sense of, like, anticipation of, like, oh, I do hope I get to put those shoes on again and weigh that one for one last time. And, you know, it was particularly poignant on the last film when we were doing those last scenes that we were involved with as well.
Actually, it made you very nice to us.
Yes, between each film.
Yeah, between each film. Yeah.
The most interesting character in the movie. Well, I think the baddies really. I like baddies. I'm wondering what horrible thing they're going to come up with next. I find that very exciting, I have to say.
Yeah, Voldemort and Wraith is extraordinary, and I remember the first scene that that's the one that's come up, and the first scene that we're all sitting at before I get that from David, in Malfoy Manor, and we were all sitting down the long, long table, and everybody's, you know, I'm sort of very new, and everybody is, you know, either introducing themselves or, you know, saying hello, I haven't seen you for a week, which is quite a long time, apparently, from this lot to be apart from each other, is chatting, and we know that he's going to do this speech, and Rafe starts, and you suddenly realise at the end of the speech, when he hasn't called cut and Rafe is still improvising and walking around the table, and every actor's game just goes do 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 do, and you go, all right, that's why he's playing Voldemort. He's superbly good, and to watch him as an actor as well, what he does and how he uses the camera, and he's standing and he's saying, so I'll be moving from there to there to there to there to there. The precision is superb, and that sort of piercing quality that he has as a practitioner comes across in the character. So I think Voldemort is, yeah, entrancing. But then,
yeah. Snape's a very interesting character too, because there's a revelation about Snape in the final film, which of course I'm not going to tell you if you haven't read the book already. But the films, Snape's character has been building to something over the course of the books and the films, and that is, it's a very interesting revelation.
He's not really given enough credit, Snape, because he holds so much inside himself, and I think most people, you know, they go around, they have people they speak to, people who love them, and I think with Snape, no one loves Snape, you know? Everyone's kind of, it's true though, you know, everyone's kind of intimidated by him. Or Dumbledore, you know, even Dumbledore, he admires him and he kept Snape there, but Snape's just living for himself, he's living for Lily, you know, you find out about that, and it's really sad, and I just think he's a really amazing character.
Yeah. Even his mum didn't like him.
Sucks for him.
I think it all starts with the source material, because Joe was very smart and wrote a singular story told over 7 volumes. I think we just tried to do 7 different episodes in Harry's life in a single year or a couple of years at school. It would have got quite boring quite quickly. But because it's a singular story, it was always building to the end. And she also writes characters that people find plenty to resonate with, whether you're young, old, middle-aged or whatever. Know that she deals with most of life's great issues in terms of, you know, growing up, life, death, friendship, choices, whatever you can think of in some way or another, it's covered within the course of the books. And people just fell in love with the characters. I think that's, they just couldn't wait to see these people up on screen. And she was very, very smart in the way she created them.
Characters actually grow up throughout the films.
Yeah, they're the most expensive home movies of all time. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Robbie, at the end of the day, what do you think Hagrid's influence was on Harry, and what do you think Harry's influence was on Hagrid?
Oh, blimey. well, at the start, he was a sort of uncle figure, sort of father figure. I mean, what was interesting about Hagrid's position in a sort of hierarchical structure of Hogwarts is that he's sort of a member of staff, but he isn't quite. I mean, it's significant that his hat is X number 100 feet away from the main building. And I always thought of him as like, I don't know, at school if you had the janitors at school, but there was good janitors and bad janitors. There was the janitors who sided with the kids and would probably lie to the headmaster to push as to who broke the window. And there was the little officious one that everyone hated. Hagrid was a good janitor. And Harry's welfare was really his only concern. He's not ambitious anyway. That's the way it started. And then, of course, as Harry starts to grow up, he relies less and less on Hagrid, and because he, you know, it's more Dumbledore and it's more the magic and the things he's discovering, the dark forces and what powers he can develop and so forth. So they, although they're still pals, it was a different relationship. It changed throughout the films quite definitely. Oh, and then Hagrid was terribly, terribly honoured to be looking after somebody with, you know, who was the boy. You know, he was the golden boy, so I think Hagrid really liked that. But Hagrid knew all sorts of strange things about the Dark Forest that other people didn't know, and he wasn't exactly the brightest knife in the drawer, let's be honest. But a thoroughly decent man. I get letters from kids saying, I wish my dad was like Hagrid, you know, because Hagrid wouldn't hit my mum and things.
Unless you ring up Saturn.
Well, you're 8 foot six, you can do a lot of damage. But he was a father figure to lots of kids, actually, because he was a big, strong man. You know, and that, no, I'm serious. You should see some of his letters, it was lovely. I got a lovely letter from this girl from Russia. She said, I live in Moscow, only 17th floor. She sent me a photograph of the building. She said, you could fly in the window some night and sort out my father. Do you know what? I could have a bloody word. Just a little anecdote there. Sorry, say that. Sorry.
Thank you.
I see movies and we buy DVDs and Blu-rays.
I mean, it's exciting when you know that the next book comes out. You know, you always jump to, you know, flick through and try and see the reference to your character. That's the first thing I did anyway. But I mean, there is a scene in the seventh book that we've shot, but I can't talk about because it's in the second part of the Deathly Hallows. No, I can't.
Oh, no, you can't.
But yeah, I mean, that would be a favourite sort of scene from that particular novel. But I mean, if we're looking at the other novels as well, book number three, Prisoner of Azkaban, was my favourite book, particularly the time-turning sequence. And when I'd read that, I was always fascinated to see how it would come across on film, and it didn't disappoint, certainly. It was how I imagined it would be, if not better, just to see it played out. It was absolutely fantastic.
But also, when you look at the book, it's not necessarily what will be filmed, because as you know from the book, often characters are left at one place and two, three chapters later you find them. And so what's interesting with the filmmakers is which threads are they going to follow, which threads are they going to drop, you know, and then from filming it, when they're looking in the edit suite, what comes through, so it's a movable feast, isn't it, constantly?
It's a constantly moving feast, yeah, absolutely, because you can, in the cutting room, you can restructure within reason subjects and material that you have at your disposal, but you can, in the script and maybe the book, someone will go from A to B via C, but you can actually send them from A to D via B if you're lucky enough to have the right material, and it seems to work better in the structuring of the film.
It's been amazing, as I've said, it's 10 years worth of work, and yeah, you do. I mean, you develop as a performer, I think, through doing a project like this, and then in just your life as an actor as well. You know, being known for being in Harry Potter as well, and it's the delight that you can bring younger members of the audience as well. You know, you see the wonder and the kind of the magic in their eyes when they meet somebody from the film, and you've had an impact on their lives and kind of their growing up and their imaginations, and that's really terrific. You know, it makes you feel good about what you've done. You know, because when you're acting in movies as well, it's kind of a sort of a lonely process. You know, it's not like a stage act where you stand up there and you receive your applause or your laughter. You know, you're doing it to a lens, basically, and you know, the director might say, you know, well done, or that was rubbish, we'll get someone else. But you know, that's your reward there. But you know, when you go out and you meet people and they say, oh, we love the movies, you know, I grew up watching the films or what have you, that's very touching. And
I think what was unique though were, and hard for me to say as I'm not the performer, but the unique situation here was the fact it was the longevity of the project meant that even though each film, each book and each film was a different look at a part of the world, the Wizarding World, you actually could get a chance to look at what you did last time. And actually, you know, the same process produced, you think, oh, maybe we won't do it like that again. Actually, we'll give another chance. We can actually have a go at it and cover it from a different angle, which you normally don't get because the film's a one-off, and once you've done it, and that's it for posterity. Well, you know, good or bad, that's where it is. So I think certainly for producers, we learned a lot as we went along and refined our techniques and honed our techniques, and hopefully for the better.
David, did you ever feel like a huge responsibility, though, to the original work from J.K. Rowling, because it's so well respected and admired and successful that you were given the task of bringing it to the screen?
I think the first thing we set out to achieve was always to make a film that Joe would be happy with. Transferring a novel to the screen is not always easy, and many authors are very precious about every word that they've written, and Joe certainly wasn't. She clearly understood that the book was a book and the film was a film, and sometimes changes and compromises had to be made in the translation of one to the other. But we set out always just to make, our primary objective was to make a film that she would be happy with, because if she was happy with it, it meant hopefully the fans would be happy with it. And if she and her fans are happy with it, then we could be happy with it. So that's his responsibility. But she trusted Steve Clavis, particularly Michael Goldenberg, for the film that he wrote. But Clavis particularly, she trusted implicitly. And David Heyman, who was there at the very beginning, which I wasn't, she trusted implicitly. And so it never felt like a dangerous task. It was one we always had to be tough on ourselves to make sure that we didn't accept compromises that we shouldn't accept. But it didn't ever fit. It was fun. We really enjoyed it. It never felt dangerous.
Speaking of longevity, it's not ending. We've got exhibits like this. Does that give you a sense of that feel that things will keep going and this will extend in the future?
Well, actually, I hope people enjoy the exhibits because there's detail shown here that often we don't even see in the films themselves because they're there. They're part of the fabric of the world that we're trying to create, which I hope helps everybody here work and live and inhabit the world that we were trying to create. And I think it's another unique experience for people to get the opportunity to come and look at the detail that they normally would not get to look at.
Weird. I have to say, it's very odd. Oh, of course, I've been in El Zoom yesterday. It is kind of odd, I have to say.
You
place in at these prices, I'm my little New York yes.
Those of you that got the tour yesterday, what struck you? What were you most immersed with or impressed with?
I think it's the fact that it's not just some exhibits in some cases. It's kind of it transports you to the world that we were used to seeing at Hogwarts, and it really is terrific. There's some amazing things. As David said, the detail. You know, this is a tribute to the artists and the craftspeople who have put all of this together, the costume makers, the designers, because you'll get a chance to appreciate the intricacy and the detail in it. You know, one detail that always struck me as a performer was, you know, when you put the costume on, it didn't make you feel like the character, and to open up your robe and see a wand pocket inside all ready for the wand. And it's those little details that make it easier to inhabit the character and hopefully you'll get a chance to kind of appreciate all of the work that they did, because you know how great we are already. But it's the people, you know, behind the scenes this exhibition's all about them and the work that they did on the films.
Matt, you got to give some instructions to the curators.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, yesterday, yeah, I told them to change my wand because it wasn't quite right. It was upside down, and I was like, it has to be. You've got to see the top of it, which looks like a Venus flytrap, which is why I picked it. So that's what you.
Ivana, anything that struck you in the evening?
It's just so nice to see it all up close because often when you're on the set, there's all these guys that are like guarding them with their lives. Like, don't touch that, you know? And I love the Phoenix Fox, the life-size version of it. And it looks like it can be bird. You know, obviously the Phoenixes aren't real, but it looks it.
Yes, they are. Sorry,
I have to break it to you. but yeah, and Dobby especially. I love Dobby. He's so cute. Most important one is that you see in Harry himself. Like, he's the main character, but there isn't really anything extraordinary about him. Like, half of the books, Harry's like, why is this me? Why am I the chosen one? And we're like, yeah, why? You know, because he's a teenager and he's kind of fumbling around and he's always saying, I couldn't do without you, without his friends. And I think so, that's what the message is, that, you know, he's a normal boy, but he has this need that he wants to do good, and he, you know, he's respects everyone else and everyone joins in, and that you see what he achieves. You know, he defeats Voldemort, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times, and it's just because he wants to and he has the will to do good. And I think that's the message that the book sends, that if you have the will inside you, if you do it, you know, with all your heart, then yeah, you can do pretty much anything.
And also the extraordinary complexity of that, because there are so many archetypes now in cinema, particularly for, you know, young people that are, you know, sort of like get as quick as you can, you know, for the least amount of effort, this is the way to live life. And it's a very confusing message to give children. One, because, you know, it's a terrible waste of your life when you're lying on your deathbed when you're 17 and go, oh, that's not what life's about, shit. And secondly, you know, what she writes about, and definitely what the two Davids have picked up and run with, is the complexity of trying to do good. You know, that the good is often seen now in society as a very simplistic thing. It's the things that really rather stupid people do that are very, very simple, that have no ambition. You know, this is a complete lie. You know, if you look at the moral philosophy, very, very difficult. And you see this struggle in this young boy and everything that he has to go through and what you have to do to become a man and to have peace within yourself is something that every single person knows in the audience. And you don't have to be at Hogwarts to have these kind of challenges in your life. And I think it's wonderful to see it in a very positive way, with the complexity and the intelligence and giving that to the children and the people who are watching it. I think that that's one of the things that she looks at in the books that has been taken up by the filmmakers and run with.
And I think she also teaches us to celebrate difference. We're not all the same, and outsiders are not necessarily bad people because they're outsiders, they're just different. And it's a very important message for kids particularly, I think, to understand. And she also teaches about making the right choice. And I think that's something that's embedded within the books and the films, making the right choice is not easy. Making easy choice is not always the right choice, and very often it isn't. I think she's very, very strong on that. It's a really clear message for children.
Ian, and then over here.
For the folks who have been in multiple films, how big a decision was it for you back when you made the decision to be involved to do that? To say, I'm going to take this role and play it multiple times over many years, and how happy are you that you made that decision ultimately at the end of the day?
My children made the decision for me. I was told if I didn't play Hagrid, I would not be able to arrive home again. Because the wee fella had told all his pals, because they said, "Tree, you're going to play Hagrid, you're going to play." Well, I haven't read the script yet. I said this before, the worst thing to be in a crap Harry Potter film. That would have been, if it had all gone horribly wrong and the wrong people had got hold of it, but that's established that they were very safe hands. So it was a very easy decision indeed, I'd say. Oh yeah, no, they love it.
It's funny, but when we made the first film, we didn't know they were going to make any more of them. We were just making that film as far as I knew. So I never had imagined that it would be something that would occupy 10 years worth of my career. I would have bought a house near the studio if I'd known, But it was, it's terrific. I remember auditioning for the first time with Chris Columbus for Professor Flitwick, and just having loads of fun with it. And he was a character that had always been in me. I had some home movies from when I was about 12 or 13, playing an eccentric professor in a laboratory I'd made in my bedroom, that's been a character I've always wanted to play, so I don't have a chance to do it in something like this was absolutely terrific. And then the bonus with that first film, I remember the phone calls, you wait for weeks after the audition, and it's the most anxious time for an actor, and driving my wife crazy during that period. But they said, "Oh, you got the part, well done." I said, "Oh, thank you, that's fantastic." He said, "Hold on, you also got another part, you're playing two parts in the movie." So how's this possible? So it was really terrific, but so glad that I said yes, really.
I didn't really make that decision because I got offered. Firstly, I'd auditioned actually for Professor Quirrell in the first film. I didn't get it in heart at that, which I'm very glad, because he died in the first film. And then when we were making The Prisoner of Azkaban, the book, The Goblet of Fire, was out. And, of course, Lupin is not in that, nor did it look like he would return at all, so I thought that was it. While we were filming The Prisoner of Azkaban, The Order of the Phoenix was published. And I would town with lots of little kids dressed as wizards and witches and all sorts. And nobody knew me, except I was in Prison Azkaban, was not out by then, so I thought I can go amongst them and they've got no idea who I am. But I'm there, I look, I've got the book, I'm in the queue, and I start looking through it to see if I've got another job, basically. And I see that Lupin's mentioned in the present tense, and he's saying things, and I'm like, this is great, I've got another job. And I flick near the end of the book to see if I'm still there. I'm still there. And at the time, there was a major rumour that one of the major characters in the Order of Phoenix was going to die. And I thought, well, it's not me, I'm still there right there. And the man behind me said, tapped me on the shoulder and said, excuse me, are you looking at who dies? And I said, no, I'm just looking. And I couldn't explain to him why I was there. And he announced to the whole shop, he went, he's looking at who dies! During which I did happen to glimpse, by accident, that it was Sirius Black, who was, you know, Gary Oldman was playing, who was living very close to me at the time. I saw him the next morning. And he said, and he somehow he got his hands on the book, and he says, have you seen the new book, Mike? And I said, yeah. He's got a lot of work to do, Mike, haven't we? And I go, yeah. Have you no, just read it, flick through it a bit like that. Good luck.
Are we here to talk about the second film or the first one today?
Can we say
you're
not giving away too much.
Fine, okay.
No real reveals.
Very good.
Harry's in the next movie.
Okay. It's challenging. Yeah, actually, it's challenging to present. It's one thing presenting action where people have sort of weapons of mass destruction and guns and things that blow things up, but when you have a wand, it's actually quite difficult to stage action in a way that feels suitably strong and aggressive, and so a lot of thought was put into that. So
one helps to really get all that essence of it. I think it's number six is really weird because me and you were stuck outside, remember, really, really cold outside the Weasley's house. And they're like, right, so there's big fire snakes and you've got to fight them. There's nothing there. You can't really admit it, but like, they're an idiot, really. Like, 3 a.m, like, oh, snake.
You always feel an idiot with a wand. You know, treat it like it's a magnum and holding someone like that. And it's a chopstick, right? that's the hardest thing in the whole film for me, is fighting with a wand.
The insurance people wouldn't let me on it, sadly. And that was a start.
Not when it was flying.
Not when it was flying. Spoil sports. Yes. Upside down in dark tunnel. What a lovely day that would have been. But there you go.
Yeah.
A lovely bike, haven't they? They made that from scratch, you know. The techie guys, the guys that build all that stuff, you cannot believe. They had to build I'm not giving away too much, they had to build a motorcycle that was 75% the size of a real one, of a normal one, and until you touch it, you wouldn't know it wasn't. It was just staggering quality of work. Everything, I mean, I was thinking yesterday, looking at all those little exhibits, all the little bits of jewellery, the little knickknacks, they're all made as well as if they were going to be in Faberge's bloody window. You know, they're so well done. I just got down the techie shed because they always had somebody to show you. Because when you think about it, if you're making a hippogriff, you don't just go down to Pet Boys and say, like a hippogriff ball joint, please, for an upper leg. You've got to start from scratch. And they studied horse movements. They filmed horse movements. Every single feather was put on by hand. And hand dyed. When you were there, it looked absolutely real. And do you remember the first one they had that could twitch? You know, that wee boy, this poor wee kid. I think it was a a spark sound went up like that, and the ground like that, and he just leapt into the air. It was fantastic.
I mean, these guys have been working on it for so many years, and they're a very close family. And I was pretty nervous. But I mean, as I said in the other interview, I mean, I met Dan just on my first day doing a costume fitting, and he introduced himself to me, and then he saw me 3 weeks later, and he said, "Hi, Freddie, how are you doing?" I was like, "This." He meets so many people a day, and he just remembered, and it made you feel so welcome. And these guys are just so great, so talented, and they just welcomed me with open arms. So I was just so happy to join such a great cast. And I was, after being nervous for one day, I then spent the rest of the time in Bliss. It was so much fun. So I was just so honored to be part of it.
Yes, well, I was a bit different because I wasn't an actor. I was just a huge fan, and I had an idea of everything that was what it was like. And my first day was on the screen test, and I hadn't got the part at that point, but I knew it was going to be meeting. And I was meeting all these people and all these faces, and we were meeting the Davis and Daniel. And I was like, "Yeah, I was telling them their names. I know you. I know your birthdays. I know." And I know. I had to tone it down because I really wanted the parts, you know. They were so nice, and Dan, I remember he knew that I was a nervous wreck, and he was showing me around, and I think at one stage, because I just was just staring, and I'm like, "How are you walking and talking and to me at the same time?" And I had to ask him, "Can I just touch you and touch him?" He's very good, he humored me. But it definitely, like, it took me ages to settle in there, because I was just so stunned, I was awestruck by it, and everyone, like, you know, I expected them kind of to just be their characters, and we'd be sort of replaying the books. And so, I was, you know, when I met Draco Malfoy, I was like, "Keep your distance." You know? But everyone was so nice. I did settle in after a while.
Yeah. I think actually Dan is an extraordinary human being. They all are, but Dan particularly is a real leader on the set, and for someone so young, he takes a tremendous sense of responsibility. And so when new people turn up, especially among the cast, but also among the crew, if they were they sort of parachuted into this big group that had been together for years, he was always really aware of the newcomers and went to great lengths to make them feel comfortable and happy. Actually, he was quite extraordinary.
That's why there's such a good atmosphere on set, because he's the central figure, and it all starts with him, and he's there cracking jokes and he's breaking the tension. Like a lot of people, when I came out on the set, I was just so afraid, and he, most people, you know, they keep the distance, like, "Oh, you know, leave her." But he saw it, like you said, responsibility. He was like, "Okay, I need to make this person feel at home," and everyone feels that. That's why there's such a,
it's hard now to think of an example of how we change, but it's really unusual to have this extended run essentially doing the same thing. That makes it sound very dull, but it wasn't, because each book is so different. It's another year. The tone is different from book 5 to 6 to 7. Even 7, the way we've split it, part 1 and part 2, they're very different films. I think there was, like, in the early days particularly, there was a lot of learning about how to manage large numbers of young children, because that was particularly taxing, really. We educated people. We taught things as diverse as Gaelic and Latin, as well as every other subject. It was from the Irish education system. We had people from Scotland, from Wales, from all over, and trying to...
Yeah,
no, she implored.
way that we could work the 4 hours a day that you could work with the youngsters on set, but also to provide them with an environment that allowed them to properly be educated, because you can't just sort of throw it away. If it's not day here and there, it's a different thing, but you can't just throw it away because we have a big responsibility towards all the children. So in the early days, it was that. And actually, the way we use visual effects to help tell stories rather than just to be visual effects and things like that. I mean, it's one of those things, anything you do, every film you make, you learn a bit more. Or I find anyway, maybe I didn't know very much to start with, I'm not sure. But you learn a bit more, and in these, it just seemed each time we'd all get together again and say, okay, let's have a bit of a post-mortem, what happened last time, what shouldn't have happened last time, and how can we make it better this time? And hopefully we did. Well, each of the, Chris Columbus did do two films. He was asked if he wanted to do the third. Alfonso was asked if he wanted to do the fourth, Mike the fifth. And they all, Chris did two, which was a sterling effort, and then felt that actually it was not fair on his family. He had to come back to America. Well, he produced the third film too, but after that, he felt he had to return. Alfonso and Mike were both tired. They didn't feel they could step straight in because there's no time off between these films. We were in post, we were prepping the next one, and whilst we were releasing one, we were just about starting to shoot another. And then David Yates came. So they all put their own stamp on the films. And then David Yates came along, and he was a perfect candidate for five. We loved working with him, so as with the others, we asked him if he'd like to do six. And then he said yes. At that point, we didn't really have a long-term view about whether seven, which we thought would only be one film, should be done by the same person. But David, 6, he wanted to make a very different film from 5, which he did, and aided by the material being so different to start with. And then he said, I've started, 6 is kind of the beginning of the end, because it's where we learn about Horcruxes, and Harry starts that, the first tentative steps on the final journey. And so he wanted to do 7, and so we thought, great, and then unfortunately for him, 7 turned into 2 films, so we almost killed him. But he was always very keen that each film was very different. He didn't want to remake the last film, so he was really keen that tonally and stylistically the films were different. So it was like having a new director each time for us, really, even though we had him for half the franchise.
We have time for one last question.
The end. we hope they'll be happy that once again we've managed to make a proper filmic version of the second half of Joe's book. It's full of action, but it has a really strong emotional core. So it stops just being stuff, we hope. And we hope by the end of it people will care and feel that, we've reached a satisfying end to this epic journey that Harry has undertaken.
Will that really possibly be the end?
Well, it is for now, and that's for sure, because there aren't any more books. If there were, we'd make them, but there aren't. So, and Jane, as I said before, it's a singular story told over 7 volumes for her, and she's reached the end of that story, and she's told us at the end of the 7th book what happens to Harry, Ron and Hermione later in their life. So there's pretty little room for manoeuvre there, I think, unless she comes up with something else. But to my knowledge, she is not. She's busy doing other things, and she's very happy with what she did on these and is enjoying her life as it is. So.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you out there at the